Welcome everyone to the next episode of ThreatSight Podcast. Today we are discussing everything what happened in December of last year, because it's January, and we have our special guest here, Sorry Not Sorry. Hello, Sorry.
Hey man, how are we doing?
All good, and what about you?
Ah, great, thank you.
Cool. So yeah, maybe let's start with your story. I guess like most of the people already know you, but if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I am known as Sorry Not Sorry, and I have a strange story, I can say. My contribution in Web3 just began with many of coincidences, and I was a ship captain before and found myself in this rabbit hole by just some interest, by just some coincidence, by just some, I sent one submission to C4 and it was accepted, and later on I took some ambitious time to prepare myself again, to improve myself, and finally I'm here.
Yeah, this is lovely. Like first of all, this is like unrealistic that you went from totally non-technical fields to here, and you are like crushing it. And any, secret sauce that allowed you to transition?
I think I can say you should not be afraid of being tired. And this is really a painful path unless you have a, mentor or someone teaching you, I can say clearly. In my situation, I didn't have, so I needed to utilize all my time, after work hours, I need to study, I need to check the contests. So everything was so packed. So it was painful. And the secret sauce, I can say, just get up and do it again and do it again. That's my secret.
Okay, you know how to say like no pain, no gain. So you are the perfect example of that.
Thank you.
That's very true. And a lot of the auditors in the space are, they are very competitive, right? So it's like if you don't put in enough hours, I mean, you're competing against people who are putting in way more hours, for instance. So you basically have to match it in order to be at the same level or better if that's your goal. So, this isn't kind of like an area where you can just slack, basically. You really have to put in all that you can give and just continue grinding. So I definitely agree with your mentality, Sorry. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree with you. I mean, the ecosystem is not fair. I mean, look at the guys. They are married with children and they have to compete with the guys who are like 19 years old, auditing 16 hours a day, doesn't care anything. I mean, how can you compete with these guys? But at the end of the day, you come to one conclusion, like you are better or worse. And that you think like you have to contribute more.
Oh yeah, this sounds too close to home for me, personally.
Kudos to those guys, really. I really respect them a lot.
Yeah, and this is crazy. Like you see this guy, like recently the Stormy, for his first competition he did on C4. And he already got like first place and... Yeah, and he's like, I think 16. I think that Chris Apostolov. So yeah, I think Chris Apostolov like said something like that.
Yeah, it's very impressive. Very impressive.
I like, but by the way, I think that young people are particularly good in security. I know maybe it's because their brains are just, more flexible, or they have more free time, or maybe they can like focus on it for more extended periods of time with less sleep. Or I don't know.
Yeah. It kind of depends on context as well, because I know a lot of the people who... You kind of have like a few different groups of people who, use computers, right? You've got normal people who transition to computers and use them. You've got people who have also grown up using computers, right? Like myself, I used to always use forums and everything. And it's very easy for me to kind of put so many hours into something like Web3 security, because it's no different than like Web2 security that I learned from forums, for instance, where I connected with other hackers. And ultimately, it's kind of like the same way as if like you grew up playing games. Life is ultimately a game, you can treat it the exact same way, right? Whether you have like items on a game and you want to look good, it's the same, IRL. You want to get good. You want to keep leveling up, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like the younger generation can kind of adopt that mentality much easier, specifically if they grew up on computers. As well as playing games. But I would say it's really more relevant to those who did grow up on computers, because they also have the computer literacy already kind of building. So again, that's something that, plays in the transition to Web3. As well as Web 2.
Yeah, makes sense. Oh, so you know, on the same note, like, sorry, not sorry, you are not the youngest guy, right?
I know, I'm 40.
Yeah, so you are on the opposite end. So, do you find it hard, you know, to you know, spend so long hours in front of the computer?
No, it's not difficult actually, and I really enjoy it. The hardest part is like I don't make it in enough time, like in 24 hours. I need like 40 hours a day. I mean, especially when you have a family, the kids, and you know, you have some kind of responsibilities. So yeah, it's not like your age is like when you're 16. When I was 16, I was only dreaming about playing basketball. I was doing that one. Now I am trying to do the same. And I mean, people don't allow me to do that one, really.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I think that everyone in the space like needs, you know, like at least 40 hours a day.
Many, many hours per day.
Yeah.
It's just continuous grinding.
And
if it's not learning and it's testing, you know, it's there's so many different phases to it that you really have to master, let's just say.
Yeah, like this is like really complex skill to possess. Like it consists of so many like small stuff, like understanding the code base quickly, being, you know, just knowing the vulnerabilities, which is just a vocabulary. And then, you know, you have this knowledge and then you apply it to the code base at hand and so many more. So yeah, continuing. But you started with C4, right? And you did it for quite a long time. But recently, if I'm not mistaken, you are scout or
I'm a lookout.
Lookout. Okay, sorry. I always mismatch them. Okay, so what lookout actually does?
Okay, let me tell you the comparison with lookout and the scout. Scout prepares this repo of the contest, so they're responsible of, you know, in details to provide to the warders when the contest start. And the lookouts, our job start after the contest start. So first of all, we judge the bot race, which is kind of difficult because we have like 24 hours deadline. And nowadays there are like 19 bots contributing to the bot races. And if this is a large code base, like 3,000 lines of code, and the bots are providing you 15,000 lines of code, and there are 20 of them. And you have 24 hours. And to make something precisely accurate, you really require to go manual bot. And I'm kind of doing that one, like going 16 hours straight. Yeah, but it pays out, you know, once you see the bot racers are happy with your results and you just provide them some kind of positive values, they are okay. So there is no harm, no fight, nothing. And also the wardens just make it valuable. And after that one, once the contest complete, we are granted to access to the repo that we need to pre-sort. Pre-sorting means we have to just, you know, make it duplicates and primaries in, you know, in batches, just, you know, filter all this GPT and, you know, out of scope submissions. And finally, we provide like 100 issues all in all to the sponsors. So sponsors don't necessarily go through all the spams or out of scopes or duplicates. So they're just checking one, and in case they like to go deeper, they can go deeper. And finally, the, you know, repo goes to the judge, and just judge starts to judge it. So lookout's job just clearly is ending once they deliver the repo to the sponsors.
Okay, like this is cool. Like I was not fully aware of what's happening under the hood, because I still, you know, see that some of the sponsors are really giving their feedback even on some issues that was first, you know, sorted out by in the pre-sort phase. So yeah, I thought that they still, you know, have to go through it, but it's actually cool because right now on every contest, like how much there is like findings that are submitted by wardens, it's like 1500, something like that. Clearly over 1,000. Oh my god, yeah.
And you know how much is delivered to the sponsors? Like 100 max. So 90% of the issues are already, you know, sorted into spams and duplicates or out of scopes.
Whoa, who would have thought? But I guess like from your experience, like what kind of like invalid bugs are the most like, or the duplicates, like some well-known issues, or maybe something that like even was caught via the bot racers, but the people were not really, you know, looking into the outcome of bot racers or, you know, what
I can say. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I can say that people are not following the bot race results a lot. Okay. Even the big names are not doing time to time. I don't know why, but maybe they just think that their contribution with an out of scope will be leading to a higher, you know, judgment or something. But it is not the case. There is already a rubric that if you submit an out of scope issue, it will not be accepted, whether it's valid or invalid. It's already there. And for this context, people are mostly sending centralization issues where the bots are reporting like these trusted roles. They have this, you know, only owner, only admin things. All these are, you know, are known issues, and people are continuously sending those issues. Okay, there's a small line there, just the thin line. Like many people saying, okay, if the admin calls this function, it will break. But there's a other line says, the other part says, no matter who calls this one, the function logic is incorrect. So some smart guys are finding that the admin functions are not incorrect. So I can say that many times some solo findings are coming, popping from there, really.
Oh, nice to know.
Yeah, just check the admin functions. Okay, it's out of scope, but the logic might not be correct at all.
Yeah, like I personally don't, like when I see that the contest have some findings that are out of scope, I really hate it, because like many times I see some logic, you know, logical issues or any kind of vulnerabilities in those contracts that are out of scope, and like it's hard to tell like whether I should submit them or they will be ruled out as out of scope. I always have this problem, what really to do with them.
You can find a way, in case you think that that's valuable for the sponsors, you are free to submit it, but there is no guarantee that it will be, you know, rewarded. I mean, from the C4 side, it will not be, but maybe the sponsors will, might reward, you know.
Okay. So maybe so it's worth a try.
This tends to be like a pretty common scenario as well, right, on nowadays contests. You know, one of the contracts will have something implemented from another contract, but that contract is going to be out of scope, and yet it's vital to the logic of contract A. And it's like, what do you do in this position? You know, it doesn't really make sense. You're very limited in what you can actually attack within contract A, because contract B is out of scope, but, you know, contract B is a part of contract A, logic. So, you know, sometimes it does get very confusing in terms of what's in scope and what's out of scope. And sometimes it just doesn't make sense at all. I've kind of encountered that sort of situation a few times now on Code Arena.
I think there is a rubric on that one right now, because I remember like it's accepted now. If TB is out of scope and the bug lies in contract B, B comes into scope, something like that. Confirm that one.
Okay.
Would be cool. Okay, so apart from doing pre-source on C4, like what are you doing now?
Hard to tell. New year, new goals. And right now we are doing this private audit with you. Apart from that one, I'm trying to collaborate with some teams, some crypto teams, and I'm just advising them as per the security side, the security aspect, what they can do, what they can achieve, and also as per the technical side, what they can do on the networks, which they can be leading the, you know, business. So I'm talking to many people, like every day, like 4 to 5 people like that. And apart from that, I'm trying to keep my goals straight, and, you know, doing some sports, you know, taking care of the kids. And that's it. That summarizes my life nowadays.
Okay, this is lovely. So yeah, I guess you are grinding all the time, right?
Yeah, not contributing to the contests, I can say, but you know, trying to find some cause to audit anytime, especially the private audits.
Okay, so do you plan to go back to C4 and kick asses there?
Yeah, it's every time I would like to do that one, but in order to do that one, you have to have some kind of like 25 hours a day or in this situation. I don't know what to do. I have kind of like ADHD, and I sit some, you know, like 1 hour, and the second hour, I look at another screen, look at another news, who hacked who. So all my focus is disturbed. That kind of bugs me nowadays, actually.
Okay, I hear you, brother. I have like similar issue. Like, what helps me is like doing breaks when I feel, you know, like I have a needles in my ass. Yeah, I just take like 5 minutes break, you know, and then, you know, just a quick exercise. You know, you can, you know, leave yourself breathless in like a minute, you know, burpees or anything. Like, just try to fry yourself as much as you can in 1 minute, and, you know, then wait, you know, until you catch breath and everything is calm and sit down back. Like, it works really good for me. I feel like I can like focus way longer if I, you know, give myself, you know, some ability to get rid of, you know, all these ticklings I have when I sit before the computer. Yeah, you should try it out.
I will try that. I will definitely try that, bro.
Yeah, cool. And by the way, like, what is your achievement that you are the most proud of in your life? Like, it doesn't have to be Web3 security, but like in general.
I never thought about that one, but in general, what I'm proud of is like, I am able to be able, I mean, if I think that's something I should do, I am doing that one, no matter it is like 1 year later or tomorrow. I think that summarized my strong, you know, strengths.
Okay,
kind of like discipline.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. And what do you think? What are the most pressing security concerns that we have today in Web3 security?
Most concerning?
Most pressing concerns. So, like, what is like the biggest issues we have in Web3 security right now?
Okay, I will answer the same answer which I answered during ETCC. Security researchers are not incentivized by the protocols. That's the issue, actually. I mean, who just, you know, tries to find bug and try to just make some funds out of that one. I mean, if you do that one, if your funds are not prepared by the sponsor, if they don't pay you, would you really do that one? I don't think so. Nobody does.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays we see that concept. I mean, look at what Trust Security prepared. Have you seen his, you know, Twitter post? I mean, they submitted like 50 submissions to many protocols, and it looks like very few of them just replied on that one. And what they found is like denial of service issue.
Yes.
And that's a shame, man. That's a shame. That should be really a, you know, shame board, and people should not be. But if we don't, I mean, regular users will go and use their protocol. That's the concern.
Mm.
So there's a centralization issue, I can say.
Yeah, like it happens all the time. Like, especially if you see at the end of last year, many people had these badges prepared from Immunify, how much they earned throughout the year. And in these badges, there was the accuracy, which for me is like totally invalid way of naming it, because, like, for example, if someone has 10% accuracy, that just means that he was only paid for the one issue that he found. So in case of Trust Security, as you said, like, over the 50 protocols that were vulnerable, like, let's say that only 10 paid, so you have like accuracy like 20%. But this is not accuracy, this is like the protocols that I taking, you know, this seriously. And if you and yeah, I was really curious to see, you know, how much people really were posting and how much of that they got paid for. I had this situation myself. Many of my friends had the same situation. You find some like valid bug, and for example, the new protocol comes out and you are submitting the bugs there. And they are not paying anyone in 2 weeks. They get kicked out of Immunify, and like they actually have like free audit.
Definitely. I mean, they really think on that way. I think so.
Yeah. Lastly, concerning this incentives and everything, I have a spicy one for you. There is like heated debate over the marketers type of security researchers. So, you know, guys that have no public track records, and what is your take on those guys and, you know, in general, how to prove yourself to the public?
prove yourself to the public. Either you show your audit results or either you show your wallet. I mean, yeah, everybody makes $300,000 a night and nobody sends an address that we can check. I don't know. Yeah, that kind of guys just, you know, harms the ecosystem. But I don't believe that they will continue long like this, because as I can see, there are many great researchers are in the market right now, and all this kind of nonsense posts will not be, you know, rewarded by the guys, by the sponsors. Like, I'm truly believing that one, because I am witnessing that one, really. Many great friends of mine, they are taking private audits from, you know, very, very well-known firms, very well-known companies, I mean, the protocols. And you ask yourself, okay, this is really true, because yesterday you're sitting together and tomorrow they're doing something really big. And this guy did not make any marketing on Twitter or something. And it means that good guys choosing good guys. So at the end of the day, these might not be the, you know, following each other, I can say.
Yeah, and like recently I see this change, you know, from the independent security researchers working alone to security researchers working, you know, in groups. So this is great, because we are switching this model. When you are like really good on marketing and people, you know, get you, to you are super cool and someone else want to work with you, and then you get money. So yeah, maybe this is the answer.
Yeah, that works. I also believe in that one. Right.
Okay, cool. Like, man, thanks, like, all for the insights that you gave. Like, really cool. I personally love to hear that, your answers and your story. So yeah, guys, maybe we'll go over the thing that happened in the December this year, last year. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do this.
Yeah, let's do it.
Bang. Okay, so first story is Arbitrum. It was hit by partial outage due to traffic surge. But most funny or interesting case here is that why it was really, you know, experienced this partial outage, because the thing was due to Eevescriptions. I don't know, guys, if you heard about it.
It was quite a hot topic on Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and I don't like really, I don't know if, what's your take on that, but I don't really understand the Eevescriptions. What it is just creating call data to yourself or to someone else. I'm not sure, but I guess it's to yourself. And in this call data have special structure, and this is JSON. Like, first of all, why JSON? We already have ABI, right? And second of all, like, I don't know if people realize, but we have rollups that do this. So why do you even need that? Like, Eevescriptions became popular on Bitcoin just because, like, there is no way of, like, sending tokens and anything. Like, recently we have ordinals, but Bitcoin is limited. You cannot have like smart contracts or anything, and people just took it, and it does not make sense, because on Ethereum you have all of that, right?
I agree, yeah. I think it's kind of like a case of reinventing the wheel, but you know, there's no point in doing that. So, you know, I mean, there's a reason why it became a very hot topic on Twitter, and why a lot of people were flaming the framework of Eevescriptions. I'm calling it useless, you know, pointless, and just a long list of other words. Yeah, it didn't really make much sense to me. Kind of like a bit of a buzzword as well, in my opinion, especially from like a marketing side of things. Yeah, I mean, naturally, I just didn't really understand it.
Yeah, like, we'll see how it goes. Like, there is also one really funny thing. Like, people were starting to think about, hey, what can we, you know, how can we improve on BTC in Eevescriptions? And, you know, they threw all those ideas, and the guy from L2Bit said, sorry guys, but I don't know if you know, but we already have L2 rollups that do just that.
Exactly, though.
Yeah,
it's
so
true.
Yeah, we'll see, you know, how the Eevescriptions will work out. Maybe in the bull run there will be like some kind of hype for them, and we'll see. Okay, next one is French court acquits Playpus hackers. So the Playpus hack, I don't know if you remember, was so strange, because if I remember correctly, the guys stole from the protocol, but actually failed to transfer the money. And like some of the money was hacked back, but the most of the money like was left in the contract. And no one is able to get those money because of the issues that they had. Like, or even they burned it. And now,
oh, really, I was not aware of this.
I remember that. Yeah, that Plypus was like really strange. Like when I was looking how it happened and what happened, I saw that this is like really super inexperienced guys. And the worst part for me personally, I would like to hear your opinion, but the worst part for me here is that now Kurt says, okay, we believe code is the law and you are free to go. You just, you know, use the protocol in the way that it was coded, and it is not your fault that you exploited it. I don't know what to think about it. Sorry, what is your take on that?
This is sarcastic, man. I mean, same time true and same time it's not true. I mean, the court should defend some kind of ethics. So I don't see that the court was defending the ethics of the normal people. They defended the ethics of the, you know, software programming or something. Code is law is only the thing when you try to defend yourself if you're a hacker or something. So I don't know, maybe the court is related with these guys. Who knows?
The nature of it, the whole court case is quite strange. Because from what I remember, you know, the money was in both of the brothers' wallets, shared wallet, you know, for quite a bit some time, right? So it's like, even from a legal standpoint, you can already argue that it's like, why is the money in your wallet for so long? You know, if you are claiming to be an ethical hacker, you could return the funds very quickly. Time frame, you know, plays a very big role in that. The longer the time frame and the longer that the money is under your possession, the more it looks like you have the intention of stealing it and just laundering it. Because for, you know, from a legal standpoint, you can really just argue that you're just trying to find a methodology for laundering the money so that you can get away with it. I mean, you know, that's something that, you know, a longer time frame will assist you in. Whereas if you're working on just like a 24-hour timeline, you can't really think of a very good money laundering methodology. So it was quite strange to see that they were acquitted and they just got let off. Because in other cases, I'm pretty sure people get sued, not only by the protocol team, but obviously they go to court and then they just go to prison for it. So it was quite strange to see it. I do see that obviously it was a French court. I do see that a lot of people in France get away with computer crimes. It does tend to be a trend. Not to kind of generalize it, but, you know, it is kind of the case. So again, overall, it's actually quite interesting to see this.
Yeah, and I just think that there are like a lot of security researchers in France right now. Like wherever I hear about some new security researcher, he's like either French or Bulgarian.
There are many Spanish as well, man.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah.
That's very true, yeah.
Unfortunately, not many people from Poland are doing that.
Yeah, I would say there's quite a few, but, you know, nothing compared to, like, Bulgarians or the French. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Moving on, the story from the other end of the spectrum, Cyphrin Updraft just launched. And this is cool because this is free platform for anyone to learn about Web3 security, which is well needed in this space. Like really, when I started, you know, you just gather the knowledge, you know, the bits and pieces from different articles, and you have like no definitive source to learn. And right now, not only is it free, but first of all, it's created by Patrick Collins, that is like a beast in a space, by Tincho, Johnny Time, Owen Thurm, Pashov, and other guys. So you have, you know, all stars for free. Like, this is absolutely great.
I think it's amazing content as well. You know, it, for somebody who's just really making an entry into the smart contract security area, this is a massive boost in knowledge. You know, you can binge a whole YouTube video, because I saw that Patrick also published it on YouTube. It's not only on the Updraft website, but you know, you can really binge the entire course and you could gain a lot of knowledge from there for free. So like I said, it gives you a really big boost, and compared to like a year ago, we didn't really have that. It was very problematic. You had to find all the resources yourself, you had to add them all up, you had to build the knowledge yourself, you know. And nowadays it's just way easier to kind of accomplish that. So it's actually good to see that the area is expanding and it's also developing in a positive way.
Oh, sorry. And by the way, how did you learn, the Web3 security yourself when you were starting?
The Web3 security, actually, I didn't learn. It was a long, long story. I lived in it. I learned Solidity, and I was assuming like I learned Solidity. And by the time I saw C4 and that time I contributed to the contests, I came to learn something piece by piece. And by this, like 3 to 4 months or even 5 months, I learned a bit, I can say, not my best. But it was a long, long way, really. And what Cypher and Updraft is actually amazing in terms of onboarding the people, because, I mean, you don't have to suffer. There is one door and you have to go into the door. And whatever is positive in this Web3 security, I really support that one. I really appreciate what they're doing.
Yeah, this is super cool. Like, I still think that having the quick feedback loop is great, and this is great, for example, in Sherlock, when you end the contest and you immediately have access to all the people findings and you can like judge them and learn from them. In C4 it's a bit tougher. Like, if you have the backstage role, it's okay, because like when the contest ends you also have the same. However, yeah, if you don't have the vocabulary of the vulnerabilities like re-entrancy, price manipulation, oracle manipulation, all of those case, the feedback loop, like you are not growing that much, and this is super cool. So you can like first grind like, I don't know, like 30 hours. Like some people will probably, do it in a week or less. And then like immediately go to the Sherlock, go to C4 and, start your journey and have some, immediate feedback on how much you did compared to the other guys.
I agree.
Cool. Next story. To be honest, when I like read that for the first time, I was like, there is like something more here. Like, I could not believe that the researcher was awarded like almost $2 million by Phantom Foundation just because he found that one of the compromised wallets had permission to...
It was to hold like a dormant admin token.
Oh, yeah, dormant admin token. Yeah, so I did not... I did not think that those things happens. Of course, like, great that it was the White Hat that found it, right? But, given the specialization and the finesse of some of the recent hacks, and even, just the thing that we have the automated bots that are able to, immediately scoop out some of the common vulnerabilities. Like, for example, I think that DDoB has their own searchers that are able to identify some of the common vulnerabilities on the code that is just being deployed. Yeah. But, I guess that everyone is looking on EVM and all the other ecosystems are just, their security is like really lagging behind.
Yeah, there's a good opportunity there, I can tell.
Oh, so, sorry, did you try to, switch the ecosystem to, I don't know, Cosmos, Solana, yeah, Phantom?
Of course. Last year I started, still I couldn't because I am not doing that one. I'm just procrastinating the thing, So, but I will do this year. This is one of my goals this year.
Oh, cool. Did you have a chance to participate in Zeta Chain? It was like Cosmos ecosystem on C4.
I know, once I know that it's like 136,000 lines of code, I just, I was afraid to click on the links, really.
Okay. Yeah, to be honest, I tried that. I didn't know, how well did they do. I know that I have some valid highs and mediums. Yeah, and this was new to me. I thought to myself, okay, it's a month. Like, definitely 134K lines of code. It's not something that you can really acquire in a month. But I said, okay, plan for myself for this year was to learn Cosmos, and I probably won't have, better occasion to learn it. So, yeah, I did it, but I spent like 60 60 something hours on it because I've tracked my time. And then I saw this one of these guys. He's like, well, I don't want to, you know, give the names here, but it was like, really, he's a really, you know, one of the top security researchers in the space, and he also participated there. And he found so much issues, and I just asked him, like, man, how did you do that? And you know, and most of the findings even had like coded proof of concepts and everything. I was like, I just, you know, did that, and I did not even have time to, you know, write the complete proof of concept and everything. And he was like, yeah, I was like spending, you know, full time on it. And I was like, okay, okay, makes sense. Yeah, but
motivation.
Yeah, but actually, I know that he knows Cosmos as well. He does some Cosmos audits, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, good for him. But the findings he found were impressive, and the Zeta chain was already audited before by like multiple companies, and one of them was Zelig. And I think that Zelig has like really good security researchers.
Yeah,
but still, you know, having hundreds pairs of eyes on the code is not just having like two or three people, right? Especially for, you know, such a big code basis.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
And then we also have the Venus protocol. Wow, it was hit by an Oracle attack. 0.5 BNB was deposited, and the exploit actually led to a total of 116 ETH loss. And what's actually crazy about this is that they had a C4 audit, but the Oracle part was out of scope.
Oh yeah, like this like, plays idly, you know, with what we just said about code out of scope.
Exactly. This is what I mean. Like, you know, code contract B could have been very relevant in contract A logic. And, you know, this is kind of the same scenario. It's crazy.
Yeah, like for the context, Venus protocol is a fork of Compound. The C4 audit I'm talking about is the contest when they switched to having isolated pools, because in Compound, all the pools are connected. So if any of your collateral, you know, goes bad, or you are able to exploit just a one collateral smart contract, you know, you can, you know, basically clear, you know, all the protocol from, you know, all the assets that they have. And Compound uses oracles. I'm not sure what kind of oracle Venus used, but definitely not Chainlink's ones. Yeah, like maybe some PIF, or I guess that's, you know, some kind of hybrid between maybe some oracle that is some PIF or maybe Chainlink even, but then you had maybe some on-chain oracle or anything. Cool, and next one, hi. Like, last month we were talking about Ledger and how the fake Ledger app appeared on Microsoft Store, and, you know, people lost so many money, and now we see that the Ledger Connect kit was hit by a supply chain attack. For those who don't know, supply chain attack is a Web2 style of attack when you are able to inject malicious code in the process of building code. So for example, you are have your code download some external packages to you, and you are able to infect the external packages that that it is using. So probably here it was the employee that did not work in Ledger at the time. His account was compromised and he didn't have his permissions revoked. So the malicious actors could then, you know, inject some malicious versions of one of the dependencies that Ledger was using, and people like lost over $500,000. Again, sometimes the weakest link in Web3 is Web2.
yeah, for sure. I think one of the weirdest. I think one of the weirdest things in this kind of event that happened is Ledger not revoking an old employee's permissions, because Ledger, I mean, you know, they're a very big company. And security is kind of, you know, is a very fundamental thing that needs to be held to the utmost standards, highest standards. And the fact that an old employee that doesn't, you know, work there had still had permissions to the Git repositories and everything else, it was very weird. Well, I saw all of the Git commits get posted on Twitter and how everybody was talking via the comments. And it was just, it was kind of weird how the whole scenario just played out. They were basically trolling on the GitHub commits as well. They were mocking the person that got hacked. It was just kind of strange to see that from Ledger's point of view, they just never revoked the permissions of an old employee. Yeah, it was weird.
Yeah, and I remember recently, like maybe not recently, like a year ago or over a year ago, there is this channel on YouTube, Life Overflow, and the host of this Life Overflow was looking into security of Ledger, and I think that one of the previous version had a possibility of you to using USB cable to be able to really get into the Ledger. But the Ledger said that this is not in scope, but he actually found and showed the real exploit path, how it could be exploited. So I don't know, like there is so many issues you hear about Ledger and the security and everything, and you do not hear this, you know, for example, Trezor, the other hardware wallet. So I don't know, this is not, you know, the best situation for Ledger, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the bright side, they did deploy a fix within 40 minutes. So, you know, I guess that kind of saved their reputation a little bit due to how quickly they deployed the fix. But either way, it's quite a stupid mistake with all that in mind. And the compromised file was also active for around 5 hours. So that actually, I mean, a 5 hour window, that's pretty big. When you're thinking that you're the attacker and you've got so much time to just drain as many, you know, people as you can. 5 hours, I mean, that's a lot of time. But granted, you know, Ledger did deploy a fix within 40 minutes, so that's good. But yeah, I mean, it's a crazy situation to be in.
And by the way, guys, how do you hold your crypto? Is it some kind of hardware wallet or just, you know, you are aping on MetaMask?
Yeah, I am full of MetaMask. Not that, you know, I'm so secure guy, but anyways, you can see hardware can be exploited. So as long as I keep my private keys, not only, you know, computers, I feel safe.
Personally, I've used Exodus. I've also used MetaMask. I've also used Phantom. What else did I use? Talisman as well. That was another one. But yeah, I mean, I kind of use multiple wallets. Yeah, I don't really have a specific one. I feel like it's kind of good to not keep your all of your eggs in one basket, you know.
Yeah, so I have like multiple wallets as well, but for the most part, I'm just taking the money out, you know, through centralized exchanges, you know, going to my wallet. I love USD. Nah, just joking, but to be honest, like for some reason, you know, I know maybe this is stupid, but I feel a bit more safe when I have USD than, you know, ERC20, because like I don't know when I will, you know, maybe click at some link. Like, of course you are trying, yeah, of course you are trying to be secure, but yeah, and you know, use for example things like virtual machine. You know, to have this sandbox environment, but still I know that people found issues in VirtualBox, for example, any other virtualized environments, and were able to bypass that and really to have full control of your computer from virtualized machine. So this is not good, so you never know.
Those specific 0 days, they go for a lot of money. And VirtualBox directly pay you out. I believe it's in the millions as well for something like that.
No way.
Yeah. It's a very big thing. There was a Chinese CTF where like two people, or I think it was a team, they found 2 0-days in VirtualBox in the event. And it was just crazy. I couldn't believe it because nobody found any 0-days for quite a while. And this CTF happened, and then just the team just found those 2 0-days. I believe it was 2 0-days. And yeah, like it was crazy, because the amount of like attacks that you need to chain together in order to make that happen is truly impeccable. Like it's not something that's just, you know, it's not like just a simple one way attack. It's really like five things chained together, and then you gain, you know, privilege escalation or something like that. It takes a lot of work, but yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to discover one. That's already an insane thing, but to discover two different ones, arriving at the same destination, I mean, that's a completely different task. Yeah. That's insane.
Some people are built different, really.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
I always kind of think of those sort of people who do that in Web 2 and what would happen if they just switched to Solidity, how they would view the Solidity code and what they could really discover. Because, you know, everybody thinks in a very unique manner, right? Us three in this call right now, for instance, we all approach code bases differently. So it's like, you know, it's the same with like all these Web 2 gods in hacking. It would be very interesting to see how they approach Solidity.
Okay, moving on, we have Orbitchain hack. So actually it started on the New Year's Eve, but the main hack was on the January 1st, but like it started last year. But I wanted to put it here, like attack itself is not really interesting because it's just a compromise of private keys. I will add to that later. But the thing is that initially it was believed that there was some kind of signature replay attack or something, and people like were finding so many possible issues. And I thought, okay, so I will check it myself, and I look at the code, and you know, like no way, like. All the signatures were like 7 privileged accounts, so everything was like fine, and there was no hack whatsoever. And what I want to add here, recently I saw that the Chainlight was part of the investigation, and they found, like, they said that they cannot put all the details yet. However, the keys were not compromised. So even though the all the signatures were okay, and they, if you easily recover them, because I did that, if you recover them, they are 7 out of 10 of valid accounts. But still, for some reason, like maybe it was like some inside job or anything, but they just said that it was not compromised. Yeah, and like many times you hear, the key compromise or something, and like what? And in this case, it was 7 out of 10. So there are two questions. First of all, were they really compromised, or one of the employees said, you know, it would be cool to have 82 millions? Yeah. And the second thing is, what if you have like 7 out of 10, but all the 7 private keys are on one computer, or, you know, inside the same network that can be infected by a single virus?
I mean, the worst case about this is that this is a completely plausible theory. You know, there are people who run very big projects and they do genuinely think like this from an employee point of view. I guess that's kind of like a very big problem in crypto as well, specifically. It does question what the future of crypto will look like. About the rate of occurrence of these sort of events.
Yeah, I agree also. I mean, imagine you're holding one of the keys, and all you have to do is just to, you know, convince the other 6 people holding the keys. Yeah, that's it. And everybody has like $11 million, you know, you finish it off.
100%.
Okay, next we have Levana. And this is outlier because it was not EVM based. It was actually Cosmos based, decentralized exchange. Like actually, there were, I think, perpetuals, if I'm not mistaken. The thing is here, like very, very, like, let's say cool. I mean, from the perspective of security researcher, that it exploited really how the Cosmos, and to be more precise, one of the DEX on Cosmos works, because of the fee structure. On EVM, you have like constant fee. You know how much you will pay, like all the nodes, you know, have the same fees for every transaction. However, in Cosmos, if you are communicating with other like blockchains, right, because you have this inter-blockchain communication going on, And each of them may have the fees, you know, whatever they want, but because actually they are their own blockchains. And in case of Osmosis, I think that they were using, the Osmosis recently changed the fee structure, and not all the nodes were, you know, already updated. So it actually allowed for using the stale prices and, you know, to get the money from the pools. And additionally, like in interesting history here, is that it like lasted for 14 years. 14 years. 14 days, and like no one really noticed. But and this is crux of this story. They were experiences, you know, some very evident phishing campaign and denial of service attacks and everything. So the attacker was really trying to hide themselves from the attack, because it, you know, it required the oracles to have like stale prices. And they could have stale prices if the gas fees went up and some of the nodes did not update this fee structure, and they were not trying to push the price feeds if it was the gas fees were too big. So super interesting story from the standpoint of security researchers.
Definitely. And the guy is so motivated. It's unbelievable how he did it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, how much time it took them to first of all realize that they can profit out of it, and to actually, you know, prepare the execution and everything, because I guess that there was some automated bot that was performing all those transactions.
And they kept it pretty on the low, you know, so to speak, in terms of attention. So that's actually pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So this is like my request to security researcher guys, just, you know, do, you know, anything other than EVM. Of course you don't have so big field for private audits, but just imagine, you know, how under tested and under reviewed are all the other chains. And I see that there is this hype over Solana because the price of Solana went up, but I still think that we have Stacks on Bitcoin. This is L2, which uses this kind of Lisp-like language that no one is looking at. You have no people that are actually proficient in this, apart from maybe few people that are writing smart contracts in it. And there is possibility for many bugs. We have Cosmos ecosystem, like nearly like who we have. Like we have Halborn, we have Zelic, we have Oak Security that does audits for Cosmos. And I'm not sure if anyone else is really doing Cosmos. So yeah, the great opportunity to earn some big money on Immunify. I plan to do it myself because, well, like bugs are bugs. And still without like, from my personal experience, like I realized that during the Zeta chain, even though I did not have any previous experience with Cosmos, like, so many skills like just carry over those fields. They're like more similar than different, to be honest. And yeah, code is the code and bugs are bugs. And yeah, I think that you should give it a try.
You sound like French court.
Yeah, code is the law. Oh, actually, and what is your take on this code is the law?
Yeah, code is the law, but it should not be exploited. I mean, intention is important. I mean, okay, if you make it like, you know, white hat exploit, it might be considerable. But if you don't return the assets, then it's an exploit. And you cannot blame the code that time. I mean, the thief is also a kind of, you know, responsibility to do that one, right? Not only the, you know, developers or something, but too long didn't listen. Yeah, I don't believe in that one. Code is law, but only for executing, not for being exploited or something.
Yeah, I think I agree with that premise as well. Because again, intention plays a very big thing in deciding whether code is law or not. If you're taking advantage of the code and you're stealing a lot of money, I mean, intention shows that you're taking advantage of the code, but in a very wrongful manner, to the point where you don't really want to say that code is law, and therefore it makes it, you know, perfectly acceptable to do so. So I feel like, you know, you can't really say that in every single situation, to the point where you can't generalize it or objectify it. Yeah, that's kind of my take on it. I do agree with Sorry's take, though.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What about you, Del?
No, code is law. yeah, I'm just joking, because truth being that, yeah, of course, I do agree with both of you. I think that most of the people agree on that. So yeah, if you are just stealing from someone, then, like, I don't know, like, in normal cases, if, for example, I'm stealing your wallet, you know, on the street, like, it doesn't matter that it was, you know, maybe laying on the table, and you forgot it.
Mm.
Yeah, I still, like, took it from you, and you did not want me to do that. And I guess that protocols usually do not want, you know, anyone to siphon off all their funds.
100%.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Next one. OKX Dex.
It's a fairly simple. It is quite simple, to be honest. But
quite big. But I don't know if you want picking
the only thing that makes this big is because it's OKX. And you know they're a pretty big exchange. I don't know why it's labeled as a private key compromise, though, because mainly this is an exploit of the proxy contract. Proxy upgrade, even. I wouldn't really say it's a private key compromise. Oh, well, no, maybe it is, actually, because you wouldn't be able to do it without the private key. Okay, cool, that makes sense.
Yeah. Like, one thing that I can add here is... okay, let's say that you are some centralized exchange. Of course, you need to have some hot wallets. But for fuck's sake, why do you hold, you know, all your money on the hot wallets? Like, you need, I don't know, 5% of your funds there, or I don't know how much. Some really small amount, I guess, you know, to run it daily.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to just have multiple, really, and just have, you know, sufficient amounts in every single one, and then just kind of, you know, use them in a sense of like a router, I guess you could say, you know. That's already much safer, because you don't depend on just one. And then you can account for error as well. In an event like this, you know, only one can go down and all the others are still thriving. But if you've got everything on one wallet, I mean, you're kind of asking to have a problem, really.
Okay, cool. And the last one, Hyper Network. Like, the hack itself was not that big. It was only 200,000K, but what really makes this case interesting was they're building it on Optimism stack, which I believe allows you to create your own hyper blockchain, something like Cosmos, but on EVM. But the thing here is that they didn't use the release branch, but the develop branch. And, you know, developers usually do, like, strange stuff. For example, remove some safeguards, you know, just to have some quick testing or anything. And in this case, in the develop branch, there was some faulty condition that allowed you, basically it was removing the initializer from the contract. You know, if you have, for example, Open Zeppelin implementation initializer, make sure that you have proxy, you can initialize it only once. And here, the initializer was modified and it was actually clearing the storage afterwards. So you can reinitialize it with whatever value you wanted. So the attacker just, you know, initialized the contracts again with their malicious contract and was able to siphon off, you know, the hyper tokens from the net.
This is dramatic, really.
Yeah, like,
I mean, three years ago it was so normal. I mean, it was some kind of big news, you know, but even now this is the out of scope issue in Codarena. uninitialized proxies or something. I mean, this one, I wonder if they had any audit or something. You cannot miss some kind of thing like this.
Yeah, so relatively basic.
Yeah, like I believe, you know, that because they were using OP stack, they were relying on Optimism, you know, that did, you know, all the security. But, you know, you can only be sure of the security if you are using the release branch and, you know, not something that developers are actively working on. Yeah, because developers make mistakes.
Yeah, thank to them. That's why we are here.
Without them, there will not be job for us. And actually, you know, I'm a double agent here because I'm also a developer. So, yeah, I'm shitting on myself. But yeah, I can totally relate to that. You know, like a personal story here. The first smart contract that I wrote that were deployed to mainnet. Actually, I recently do a security review of them because we saw some other changes. So, you know, the guys that I was working with asked me if I can, you know, just look at them. And to be honest, I found like a very critical issue that could, you know, you could. Fortunately, the smart contract did not hold many funds. It was just holding the fees for the protocol. But you can, you know, just take all of the fees, just like that, just by simple re-entrancy attack. And even though you had like re-entrancy guards, you can siphon it off. And even because, like, when I was doing it, like, okay, cool, like, just put re-entrancy guards in all of the functions and no one will re-enter. But actually, I did this the multi-call possibility, and it required different re-entrancy guards. So I used the second set of re-entrancy guards, and actually, I made it from re-entrancy protected to re-entrancy unprotected. And yeah, this is just to say that developers are not security researchers, like, and they do many mistakes, and they do not think about all the things that security researchers think. But I still think that security researchers need to be engaged right at the beginning, you know, to help you out with everything, because, like, as I said, developer thinks about different stuff. So you need to have, like, security researcher from, you know, very beginning to help you out with the design itself. Like me and Sori, as a side note, are doing a private audit right now. And there is many issues found by the one single design decision, isn't it? Sorry.
Yeah. Good to see.
To see for you, bad for the protocol.
To be honest, it was... I think that the easiest for developer to do it that way, because it takes off of you burden of some checks, but still what he did not see is, you know, what it can lead to in case if you are not using it as the user would. And of course, hackers are trying to find ways to use it not the way as the developers do. I'm talking for too much. So. Yeah. What do you think about that, guys?
I mean, it's pretty interesting. You bring a different perspective to the table from a developer standpoint as well as from an attacker standpoint. I don't want to go too much into detail on it. You've already been talking for quite a while, Del. But I agree with what you're saying. Is definitely something that's correct.
My take is being a developer is not easy. Everybody can be a researcher because criticizing something is very easy. You know, even the guy who doesn't have any knowledge can criticize, and at some point he can find something. You know, but being a developer, I don't think that nobody likes to do that one nowadays, especially in Web3, because you have to know all the attack path. You have to continuously monitor all these existing, you know, improving scenarios so that your code base should be prepared for accordingly, unless it's a rigid one or not upgradable or something. And there is no incentive to be a developer. So, of course, if it's not so complicated protocol. It might be easy, but complicated protocols doesn't have this kind of incentive. So I don't know. For me, I wouldn't be able to be a developer, to be honest. But I could be a researcher, only because of these points.
I do feel like simultaneously, actually, now that this has come to my head, marketing also plays a very big factor in this, because you'll see that there's always like kind of like a wave of auditors coming in, right? Everybody wants to learn how to audit and everything like that. And it's purely because it's advertised as kind of like a very luxury job. Whereas in my opinion, development jobs aren't, like, they are luxurious, but it's like they're never advertised as that. And I feel like that's kind of, it adds to the problem. Because on you know, Web3 Security Twitter, you'll see everything about auditing, how good it is. You know, cool, you have to put in the hours for it, you need to grind for it, but it's very rewarding. And I'm not going to lie, it's the exact same for the development jobs in the ecosystem. It's just, you know, I guess you could say that you do need a different mindset, because it's, you know, you're switching from attacking, aka breaking something, to creating something. But I mean, you know, in my opinion, marketing does play a very big factor in this. Because development jobs, I mean, they make even more money, right? And you can go under a firm and make more very quickly for your skill as you would with auditing, because auditing is way more competitive. So yeah, I mean, again, like I'm saying, marketing does play a big factor in this, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah, that's super super great insights from both of you guys.
And yeah. then we also have Telcoin, that I want to just talk about real quick. Telcoin was exploited for 1.2 million due to a bug in the proxy implementation contract. Essentially, every single wallet that interacted with the protocol, not really interacted, but let's say you received an airdrop, this meant that you never really called the init function within the contract. And therefore, from an attacker standpoint, you could actually take advantage of this. So all the users who may have received an airdrop and interacted with the protocol were completely in the clear. They were completely fine. But those that, you know, just kind of sat dormant, it meant that they never called the init function. And this meant that the attacker could take advantage of that and essentially drain all of the wallets which never called the function. So yeah, the total exploit was worth 1.2 million. It caused a 40% drop in Telcoin as a result. And Telcoin, until today, throughout this entire time frame, it only recovered around 50% of the 40% drop. So, I mean, it realistically went back up 20%. And yeah, I mean, it hit Telcoin pretty harsh, in my opinion, because they already lost a lot in terms of their market cap and price throughout the past few months, especially since 2021. And it was just sad to see. The contract was audited by Certik. I don't want to flame Certik. I feel like they've already been flamed enough. but Certik did, you know, in their defense, they did claim that the scope which was attacked was not included within their audit scope. So again, you know, this goes back to our conversation from earlier, where we say how on C4 sometimes, you know, the audit scope is not really accurate. And yeah, hopefully this is something that we don't see rise continually in the scenarios, because it's going to be very problematic. I feel like developers just need to be more careful with what they are putting into the scope, and just make sure that, you know, if someone has, like, let's say 100 lines of code, and they see it as irrelevant, I mean, they need to really check where it's relevant in the code base, specifically in the contracts that are in scope, and then also include that in scope, because it's, you know, it's interconnected, right? And it's very important to just have that. Otherwise, you'll be paying the price. And nobody wants to pay these sort of prices in crypto after getting attacked. So yeah, it's very unfortunate for Telcoin, but that's how it played out. And the attacker was also switching all of their Tel tokens into USDT and then probably laundered it through Tornado. I don't know if that is the case, but it does tend to be the case. So I'll say that it probably happened that way, because on the previous podcast episode, I think that was like 5 cases of every single hack using Tornado Cash to just launder the money. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And I'm just wondering, why are they still using Tornado Cash? It is illegal.
Yeah, I mean, quote unquote illegal. Even though you can still use it with no problem, it's quite stunning.
Yeah, but listen up. If you are, for example, in France, and the court is, you know, if you are using Tornado Cash, you have problem. If not, it will be all good. Okay, cool. Any last words, guys?
No, honestly, I think this was a great episode. We covered a lot of different things. Yeah, that's really my take. Thank you for everybody that's been listening to us talk for like an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, this is lovely. Sorry, do you want to add something to the end?
Yeah, of course, I'd like to. Thank you so much for inviting me today. I enjoyed a lot, so thank you very much again.
Yeah, thank you for being on here. Sorry, really appreciate it.
Yeah, all thanks to you guys. It was like super, super cool to have you here and, you know, have your perspective and hear from you and your insane story on how you went to the Web3 security.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, cool. Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks a lot to all the listeners that are listening to this podcast and made it to the end. Cool. This is all for today, and we'll probably hear, you know, like the next month or in the last year review that we are preparing. Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.